Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Chassai and I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, we'll be hearing from journalists posted in BC, Alberta, Ontario, and Quebec. Tackling the housing crisis and economic diversity is not an easy task when you live on Cortes Island with a population of 1,000 and booming tourism.
How can you have economic development in the face of a housing crisis, really? And I was just like, you're so right. This is just an all-hands-on-deck type of a crisis that we're facing.
The government of Alberta will be investing $100 million for the twinning of Highway 63 near Fort McMurray.
Highway 63 will definitely improve quality of life for the residents of Fort McMurray and especially for the oil sands workers. But it will also do more than that. It improves the quality of life for all residents within the region.
Noah Dinola will be heading to Kazakhstan to the Jiu-Jitsu World Championships, the sport's largest stage. He's only 14.
It's really about not letting the fear and your competitor get inside your head. You just got to think that you can beat him and you can do whatever you want.
Racism reports are on the rise at the Prince Edward Collegiate Institute in rural Ontario.
As we see less tolerance for racism and hate, I think we're going to see more reports of this and more people feeling safe and comfortable in coming forward to report it.
And on our radar, we see stories popping out of Ontario, Quebec, and Alberta. This and more on Viewpoints. Welcome.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
The government of Alberta announced that it will be investing more than $100 million for the twinning of Highway 63 just north of Fort McMurray. It is convinced the project will improve quality of life for residents and specifically for the residents of Fort Chipewyan. The announcement comes just a day after the province announced a collaboration with Loon River First Nation, Peerless Trout First Nation, and the Big Stone Cree Nation. The initiative would extend Highway 686 from Peerless Lake to Fort McMurray, connecting the Wood Buffalo region to northwestern Alberta. More with Ryan Hunt in Edmonton, Alberta.
The government of Alberta announced on April 28th that Highway 63 will be twinned just north of Fort McMurray between Mildred Lake and the Peter Lougheed Bridge in a $117 million investment. The highway in the region sees nearly 11,000 vehicles every day go through the area, ranging from both commercial and commuters. Kevin Weidlich, president and CEO of the Fort McMurray Economic Development, spoke at the conference about what this project will do for the locals.
Highway 63 will definitely improve quality of life for the residents of Fort McMurray and especially for the oil sands workers. But it will also do more than that. It improves the quality of life for all residents within the region. And I'm thinking specifically of the residents of Fort Chipewyan. In the winter time, when the winter road is open, the twinning of this highway will reduce commute times and increase safety for the residents of Fort Chip when they come to Fort McMurray and for Fort McMurray residents to go to Fort Chip. So it increases economic activity all the way through the north.
This announcement comes days after the agreement to extend Highway 686 from Peerless Lake to Fort McMurray, and Weidlich says that these projects are both huge.
These two major transportation infrastructure investments really demonstrate that Fort McMurray Wood Buffalo's economy is incredibly important to the province and the country, and that the province is genuinely committed.
Devin Dreeshan, Minister of Transportation and Economic Corridors, also spoke at the conference and talked highly about the region, what it offers, and how big the twinning project will be once it's completed.
Up here in the north and in the Fort McMurray region, it's obviously a special region. It's truly the economic engine of not just Alberta and Canada, and that's why this $117 million investment into Highway 63 is so important.
Preliminary work is set to begin this fall, and construction on the twinning project will start next spring. I'm Ryan Hunt.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia. And you are tuned to Viewpoints. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI and get all our stories on canada-info.ca.
A A small town school in rural Ontario has seen a spike in reports of racism on the playground in recent weeks, so much that the school administrators at the Prince Edward Collegiate Institute sent a letter to parents outlining their policies and strategies last week. The Prince Edward Collegiate Institute, or PECI, houses both elementary and high school students. School officials say there has been a rash of reports of verbal racial abuse recently, but it might not be an increase in incidents. The school has been promoting a more collaborative approach to combating the issue, so it might be that there are more cases being reported. It's not clear. However, students are getting more comfortable reporting incidents as they arise, says the school principal. Details with our new journalist, Greg Foster, in Picton, Ontario.
PECI has been dealing with some issues of racism on the playgrounds in recent weeks, but school officials say it's not so much there are more issues, but there's less tolerance. Last week, PECI sent a letter home alerting parents of the problem and bringing them up to speed on the programs in place to combat it. Principal Andrew Ross says the school has been actively encouraging allyship among students, and that's starting to pay off.
We're doing a lot of work here to build awareness around allyship and to empower students to report, to be successful, to feel safe at school. And so as we see less tolerance for racism and hate, I think we're going to see more reports of this and more people feeling safe and comfortable in coming forward to report it.
In some cases, students have taken matters into their own hands, leading to altercations. Ross encourages students to take this information to an adult, a teacher, a parent, even an older student they trust. There have been some calls for more transparency on this issue from PECI, but Ross says that's not always possible.
Each situation that we deal with has to be done so on a case-by-case basis. And the consequences need to be considered in relation to, you know, lots of different factors, the context of the situation, age of the student, you know, whether or not the student has the ability to control the behavior that we're seeing. And that's confidential information. And, you know, related to each situation, we can't share those details publicly. And I think it does help to explain why there might seem to be, you know, some unfairness or some unfair difference in consequences from situation to situation.
Board Superintendent Tina Elliott says the trend is not isolated to PECI. The entire region is adjusting as it becomes more multiculturalized. For the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Craig Foster.
Hello, I'm Ed Halverson in Liverpool, Nova Scotia, and you're listening to Viewpoints.
Talking last week about weightlifting, and here we are again talking about sports. Noah Dinola, a Naryn District High School student, is getting ready for his trip to Kazakhstan to fight on Jiu-Jitsu's largest stage. Noah is heading to the World Championships in Kazakhstan. Naryn is a small village northwest of Toronto. Dinola has been training hard in nearby Orangeville, Ontario. Parents and trainers of the 14-year-old high school student continue to be amazed by his successes. Dinola, who began training at the age of 4, won gold in April at the Canadian Nationals, qualifying him for the international competition. Dinola trains 6 days a week. He says even though his yellow belt status has changed his fights, he will continue to focus on new techniques and styles to ensure the successes continue. Here are the details with Ryan Gillespie-Wilson and Fergus, Ontario.
Dinola won gold in April at the Canadian Nationals, qualifying him for international competition. He'll be competing in the U100-pound U16 yellow belt division. He said it was quite the experience, and the mental component of jiu-jitsu is and was crucial.
It's really about not letting the fear and your competitor get inside your head. You just got to think that you can beat him and you can do whatever you want.
Denola noted the magnitude of the possible tournament outcome really struck him when he walked into the large Scarborough gym hosting the event. The team trained 6 days a week between three different gyms, including Blaze Performance Training in Orangeville. He says even though his yellow belt status has changed his fights, he will continue to focus on new techniques and styles to ensure the success continues. Denola began training at the age of 4. His mother, Janann, has had a front row seat to watch him thrive and feels truly inspired by her son's work ethic.
He's training 6 days a week when he could be out skateboarding and hanging out with friends. He's in a gym. If it's not Blaze, it's his jiu-jitsu gyms, and he's rolling with some of the best athletes out there, and he's doing it with such finesse and grace, and he's such a resilient kid.
Scott Blazy, Denola's trainer at Blaze in Orangeville, believes the 14-year-old would be hard-pressed to come across someone with an edge over him.
With his mental strength, his maturity, and his general approach to the training, to the sport, and to executing when it's go time, I can't imagine somebody else in his division that would have any kind of inherent advantage over him.
Denola is hoping to receive sponsors to help pay for the trip to Kazakhstan. A GoFundMe page has been started with a target of $5,000, and so far, $1,600 have been raised.
That was Riley Gillespie-Wilson in Fergus, Ontario.
Hello, I'm Andrew Dow in Six Nations, Ontario. You are tuned in to Viewpoints. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca.
Cortez Community Economic Development Association of British Columbia has just hired Kate Madigan as its first formal economic development officer, and housing will be your top priority. For Madigan, who we will also note is sometimes a contributor to this radio program, addressing Cortez Island's housing crisis is a top priority, as well as fostering more economic diversity on the island. The position has long been identified as necessary for the association to carry out its economic vision for the island, according to the organization's chair, Colin Funk. He says the move has been about 5 years in the making. Here's part of Madigan's conversation with journalist Craig Osoba on Cortez Island, British Columbia.
Kate Madigan has been hired as Cortez Island's first economic development officer through the Cortez Community Economic Development Association. Madigan says she's been involved with the organization as well as others on Cortez for quite some time in various capacities.
I guess I started grant writing for CEDA, the Community Economic Development Association, and just for the Village Commons, which you're probably familiar with, that property in the middle of Manson's Landing, which is it was owned by CEDA, and they were just like, this is raw land, there's nothing on it, it actually needs to be cleaned up seriously. So I started looking for funding for them. It was a job because my job at the ambulance station as a paramedic was starting to, it wasn't as attractive for me, the hours, they had changed things up, so I really needed to find something else. So I hung a shingle as a grant writer, and of course the funding came in, and then it's like, you know the job, you know the details of the project, why don't you project manage? And I wasn't the only one doing that. We were really quite a team, the land working group of CEDA, and just things led to another because the foundation needed a grant writer, the General Forestry, Cortez Forest General Partnership, I got some funding for them for their skills training, and of course they were like, we need a project manager, so I was the project manager for that, and for training forestry workers, and the CIA. One thing led to another, and before I knew it, I was doing all sorts of grant writing and project managing for quite a range of different projects in the community.
Okay. Now, for example, I'll just use sort of a sports term here, but what is your playbook for this economic development officer job?
I was at the REAP conference last, the Rural Island Economic Partnership Forum last week in Gabriola, and one person said, how can you have economic development in the face of a housing crisis, really? And I was just like, you're so right. This is just an all hands on deck type of a crisis that we're facing. And, you know, there was actually somebody there from the Southern Gulf Islands organization that had started up and operating a house called Housing Now Registry. And they have tenants registering and landowners or people who want to rent something out registering, and they match them up with the go-between person organization. So I just thought, I had already thought that was like, that's a really short-term housing solution that maybe we need on Cortez. We've got this wonderful Rainbow Ridge project, but that's a very longer-term solution, and I think other shorter-term solutions. So that might be something that I kind of work on that I might try and get going. There's so many other things. I heard a hint that there might be some movement towards rural transportation initiatives, and Cortez and Quadra might be scoped into that. So that's another thing I'm really keen on. As you helped out with the transportation demand study back in 2017 for Cortez, we did a study for that.
That's right.
And that was one of the recommendations, was community bus or shuttle on Quadra. And Quadra needs that too. And then also there's the value-added wood products. That report has been unofficially released now with the recommendations in there as to how to further and advance the value-added wood processing for wood that's harvested on Cortez through the co-op, the community forest co-op. And so I'm really looking forward to working on that. We want to do other things like, for the organization, we would like to update the Cortez Local Economic Action Plan, otherwise known as the LEAP report, which was produced through just an amazing community engagement process. Back in 2018, it was released. And so it's been 5 years. Let's update that. And I think Colin will have a lot to say about that. There's so many other things, Greg. We want to work on climate change action and regenerative tourism. We want to work on strengthening partnerships with the other island nonprofits, maybe give a bit of a grant writing service. Seems to be something I can do. Also partner with the Clahoot First Nation on a couple of things, including the value-added wood processing idea and project. There's so many other things. We want to be involved with the social profit gathering that's coming up on June 20th and continue to be involved in that. And maybe we'll get into some social enterprise development for CETA, which is, you know, this is a way to help nonprofits fund their operation budgets. People might not know that nonprofits are actually allowed to operate a business in order to fund their activities, as long as the profits aren't going to an individual. Nonprofits are allowed to do that, and maybe we need to find out how to do that so that our nonprofits are stronger and they have the resources they need to meet all of the community needs here on Cortez.
Tune to Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
And on our radar this week, a news from across the country. We start in Alberta, where Red Dress Day was recognized on May 5th. Many municipalities across the province observed Red Dress Day, also known as the National Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls and Two-Spirit People. Colleen Dolphus, co-founder of the Indigenous Society for Fort Saskatchewan, spoke to Ryan Hunt.
There is just a huge number of women who are not being even looked for. It's over 64% of the Indigenous women population who have suffered, have passed away, or have gone missing, or who have been assaulted in all different ways, and nothing's being done for it. I know a few women who have gone missing and who have been murdered, and just because I worked in the community for many years in Edmonton at the Boyle Street and worked with a homeless population. And
Taylor McClure, based in Knowlton, Quebec, reports that students from Campus Bromissisquoi's Adult Education Center are raising funds to update the center's kitchen area so that they can offer its breakfast program once again. The fundraising goal for the center's kitchen project is $15,000. They have so far raised close to $11,000. Maude Danis-Coulombe is assistant director of the Campus Bromissisquoi's Adult Education Center.
It's a little bit different because we're an adult education center, and the breakfast program are often offered to the elementary and high schools. So in our case, it's a little bit different, and we decided a couple of years ago that the breakfast club would actually be a course as well, so that our students could learn different life skills and be able to budget and buy some groceries. So it really became a project where we would learn and then offer low-cost breakfast to our students as well.
We learned from journalist Heather Vincent Stella, Ontario, that a couple from Bath, Ontario, is going on a 900-kilometer hike to raise funds for the Soldier On. Soldier On is a Canadian Armed Forces program that assists with the recovery of ill and injured CAF members and veterans. Kim and Josh Sutton explain why this fundraiser is so important to them.
For us, a lot of it comes down to what Soldier On stands for and what the program does to help. Because they have such a focus on the physical, mental, and creative well-being of members of the military that have been either injured, that they've had different troubles, I guess, throughout it, and working on that health side of it. That definitely inspired Josh being with the military to want to raise money for it. And by doing an activity that he is working on his own physical and mental, I guess, capacity doing the Bruce Trail, it kind of tied in really well for supporting and raising money for Soldier On.
It's definitely a mix of a lot of different terrain. There is some soft pack. There's some tougher terrain as well. Our days are going to be looking anywhere from 30 to 45 kilometers daily as well. So yeah, it's a bit of a challenge, but it's a good time.
Josh will be hiking for 24 consecutive days. Go to canada-info.ca for the full stories. And definitely lots of news coming out of Ontario this week on our show. Andrew Dow, posted in Oshawa, Ontario, reports that a Six Nations archaeology team has been searching for Indigenous artifacts on construction sites. Six Nations Lands and Resources provided an update to Six Nations Elected Council. More than 100,000 artifacts were found in 2022 and 2023. Some of the artifacts date back 11,000 years. Moving forward, the team will now shift their focus to another Kitchener site, Huron South. More with our journalist, Andrew Dow.
Six Nations archaeological team provided an update about findings and artifacts that have been collected over the 2022 year to Six Nations Elected Council during the April 24th political liaison meeting. The archaeology team monitors work and construction sites for Indigenous artifacts. Tanya Hill, supervisor for Six Nations Lands and Resources, spoke on the work being done by the archaeology team and how many sites are being covered by the team.
So we have positive growth every year with the archaeological community monitoring program. Last year, we had roughly 220 different sites going on at different times throughout the field season. In regards to that, we usually have about 28 a month that kind of filter through the month.
Hill says the team has concluded their work at the Fisher-Hallman site in Kitchener, Ontario, and spoke on how many artifacts were found.
So last year we finally concluded, and I brought this to council before, the Fisher-Hallman site, where we had around, you know, I think we, in the beginning of season, we had around 80,000. As we ended that field season in 2022, there was roughly 120,000 artifacts that were recovered on Fisher-Hallman site. So we're now completed. The artifacts are now in lab going through analysis.
She says the team will now continue the work at the Huron South site, which is also located in Kitchener, about 1.4 kilometers away from Fisher-Hallman. She says she believes the two Kitchener sites are connected.
Another Kitchener site we're on is Huron South. So Huron South is probably around 1.4 kilometers away. So it's in the vicinity of the Fisher-Hallman site. Do I believe there's connection with the two sites? Definitely. They're both the same time period. So We started that site in 2020, and it's still ongoing. So it went into 2022, 2021, and 2023. We're just got boots on the ground where the monitors are just starting to get back out to the field now.
Hill spoke on what the age and time frame that she believes some of the artifacts came from.
The artifacts are like probably about up to 11,000 years old. So yeah, and that's a concern for me. And I'm thank you for that, Darren, because you know, some of the items that these museums and these archaeology companies and an essay, those are our sacred materials. Like, you know, like how do we know that some of these items we don't need for ceremony, and they're housing them. And so it's on many levels, it's very concerning. And I thank you for the support today.
Hill also detailed that work will continue on many sites within the surrounding area, including Simcoe, Hagersville, Mississauga, and Brantford. Hill spoke on the artifacts being collected and what is next for sharing those artifacts for public consumption.
We want to see those artifacts from Fisher Home and, you know, used for knowledge and you know, some sort of acknowledgement. So the Kitchener Museum's still working with us on that project of basically, you know, what is it going to look like? Are we still going to continue on with an interactive approach where, you know, they're going to bring drones in there and they're going to reenact what a village looked like? So that conversation still moving into 2023.
Hill says it's important for Indigenous communities to be involved from the start of these projects to ensure protection of the artifacts that are found. Councillor Sherry Lynn Hill spoke on her hopes to see pressure put on the Ministry of the Environment to authorize Indigenous communities to be included in conversations on projects from the beginning stages. Tanya Hill spoke on where some of the collected artifacts go after being recovered and her hopes to bring them back to Six Nations and to be housed in a facility here on Six Nations.
My ultimate goal is to see that our heritage come home. Like, it needs to come home, and we need to set up some sort of a housing facility at some point for these.
Chief Mark Hill acknowledged more work needs to be done by Six Nations elected council to bring the artifacts back to Six Nations.
That was only half of Andrew Dow's report. You can hear the rest at canada-info.ca. This concludes this edition of Viewpoints. Thanks to our journalists Craig Osoba, Ted Evans, Andrew Dow, Riley Gillespie-Wilson, Ryan Hunt, Taylor McClure, and Craig Foster. National editors Maureen McEwen and Victoria Fenner. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Get all our stories online at canada-info.ca. Great to have you with us. Please stay tuned to the show that follows on your local radio station. Until next week, ciao.
LJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
You're listening to